Okay, our topic for tonight is the prelude to the Yom Kippur War. I see everybody's in Florida on yeshiva vacation, but a handful of you are here. Good. So, the Yom Kippur War, which we'll discuss in detail next week, was not something that Golda Meir wanted. She didn't want war. She thought war was to be avoided if at all possible. Now, sometimes war is something that Israel is interested in doing. For example, 1956, Ben-Gurion decided to wage war. It was a conscious decision to form an alliance with two colonial powers and to attack Egypt. But in the early 70s, from the perspective of Israel, war was to be avoided. It could only bring bad things, not good things. But how do you avoid war? So one way is to come to a political arrangement with Egypt. Well, let's not focus on Syria for the time being. Let's focus only on Egypt. But from Sadat's perspective, he wants a complete withdrawal to the June 4, 1967 borders, something Israel's not ready to do, not even for full peace. And he's not offering full peace. He's not even offering a friendly non-belligerency. So in 1971, a survey was taken by the Americans trying to figure out which side is the greater obstacle towards an agreement. And it actually turned out that the Egyptians appeared to be more interested than the Israelis. I don't know if that's a fair assessment, but the point is that Golda was not showing any flexibility. And as I mentioned last week with the letter, the 12th graders' letter, there were those in Israel who felt that the government should be more open to peaceful overtures by the Arab states. Now, there's something that could have been done that Moshe Dayan, the defense minister, suggested in 1970, which was not as part of a peace overture, but just as a strategy in the hopes of avoiding hostility. And that was a 20-mile pullback away from the canal. Why would Israel voluntarily lose territory, withdraw to a certain line further to the east? Well, the logic was that if the Egyptians allowed for the renewal of shipping in the canal, and if they repopulated the canal cities, they wouldn't go to war because there's international commerce flowing through their waterways, and there are hundreds of thousands of civilians in the path of what would be a war if they ever decided to wage one. So therefore, they won't wage one. That you could sort of gain a greater likelihood of non-belligerency by a strategic or tactical withdrawal. It was rejected by Golda and by other members of the cabinet. Had it been accepted, would the Yom Kippur War have ever have happened? Who knows? But maybe not. It's in the subjunctive, we can't know. Well, we'll see tonight, that, and for sure next week, that the Egyptians are very much interested in peace, not necessarily with full diplomatic relations, but they want an end of the state of war with Israel. It's just they want it with their territory restored to them, and they will ultimately get that. So, with the situation not progressing, it just being a stalemate, what might be done by Egypt to alarm the Israelis? After the end of the War of Attrition, what could the Egyptians do that would get Israel to be nervous about the prospect of renewed warfare? Well, one thing would be a major military buildup along the canal, you would think. And it ultimately, that somehow didn't alarm anybody. But another thing would be the presence or the absence of Soviet personnel in Egypt. And in 1972, Anwar Sadat summarily expelled, with very short notice, all the Soviet advisors in his country. So there were those who believed that this was a favorable development from an Israeli point of view, in that there's a falling out between the Soviets and their Egyptian clients, and that war is less likely. However, one person in the establishment, Gideon Raphael, correctly assessed that no, the expulsion of the Soviet advisors actually made war more likely, not less likely. No restraint, exactly. Because as we learned from the 67 war, and as would hold true in 73, the Soviets don't really want their client states to go to war. They want their client states to behave badly in a belligerent fashion, but always short of actual warfare. And only when they go to war then the Soviets have to step in and help out. But the expulsion was to give Egypt a freer hand to do whatever it wanted. Okay. What did the Israeli administration feel was the likeliest course of action for the Arabs to pursue? So Golda's kitchen cabinet, which included herself, Moshe Dayan, Yigal Alon, and Yisrael Galili, they felt that the Arabs had no serious military option, and that once the Arabs accepted the implications of their situation, they would have no choice but to accept Israel, and that war was not going to happen. Since 1967, Amman, the military intelligence, had been saying that war is very unlikely. With this said, there were those who were nervous about the possibility of warfare and did not like Israel's setup along the canal. What was that setup? So the Bar-Lev line was a series of 45 fortifications that were separated by roughly a mile or so apart, that was lightly manned and lightly gunned. The thinking was that the physical barrier of the canal plus the rampart, the tall sand barrier, would be enough to, at least in the early phases of a conflict, prevent a crossing. That turned out to not be accurate. But because it was so lightly defended, it became something of a joke. Really a joke. Like, people would prefer to go to the canal on the premise that there wasn't going to be a war, rather than serve in the West Bank where the Palestinians were shooting, or on the Syrian border. But if there were a war, this would be a lost cause. You'd all be killed. So Ariel Sharon, similar to Dayan, suggested that they close down the Bar-Lev line and move further away from the canal. However, David Elazar, Dado, he was the chief of staff at this point in time, and he felt it was very important as a political statement for Israel to fly its flag on the canal. That even if the defenses were not all that strong and likely to hold out in the case of real war, as a political matter, it's good to have a flag on the canal. Israel did not do something after the Six-Day War that it should have. And that is, it didn't change its psychology of warfare. Before the Six-Day War, the borders of the country were right up against its civilian population. And so the thinking was that if there is full-scale war with a foreign state, that after an initial attack on Israel, Israel must go on the counteroffensive and pursue the battle beyond its borders to somebody else's turf. All right, this is what happened in 1948, where the battle was extended across the international frontier into Egypt and even into Lebanon, and of course into the West Bank to a limited extent. It happened in 1956, where the war was in the Sinai. It happened in 1967, where basically there was no fighting in Israel proper other than the shelling of West Jerusalem. But otherwise, the war was to the enemy's turf. So you always go to the enemy's turf. But what happens if the front line is now 150 miles away from your real border? The border of the Negev and the Sinai is a long way from the canal. So there really is the option of a strategic retreat in the event of a successful Arab attack. Why do you have to necessarily push back immediately and go on the enemy's terrain? You don't. You could have a strategic withdrawal. And yet the army and the political class refused to recognize the changed circumstances, and even into the Yom Kippur War, maintained the view, we always have to push on to the enemy's territory, as would happen on both the southern and northern fronts, but for reasons we'll have to get into next week.
It makes sense because there's so many more Arabs than Jews that they would want this buffer to be...
So the buffer turned out to work against Israel's better interests. On the one point is, I mentioned, you always have to push to the enemy turf, and they didn't think to have strategic withdrawal. The other is the absence of warning, advanced warning. The Sinai was largely demilitarized after the 56 war, so that going into 67, any militarization of the Sinai meant war was going to happen in the near term. But the near term is not 5 minutes from now, maybe 5 days or 5 weeks from now. When the front is the canal, and Egypt has a billion troops right behind the ramparts of the canal, they're 200 yards away from the front line, not 150 miles from the front line. So there is no longer any strategic advanced warning. Yeah.
There's a difference between the Sinai and the Golan Heights.
Oh, yes, very much so.
In the Golan Heights, you had people living there, and you had settlements living there.
Yeah.
In Sinai, it was basically nobody was living there.
That's correct. So there was a big question whether or not to evacuate the Golan Heights settlements in advance of the war. Once it was assumed that war was very near, and once the last day before the war started, it was known that war was about to happen, should the civilians be pulled down? Dayan was against it, and Golda said, as for the children, we'll take them off the Golan. We don't make war on the backs of children. That the adults will stay, but the children will leave. Okay. The children were evacuated. Yeah, yeah.
Before the war.
Yeah, yeah. On Friday and Saturday, before the war, before it started.
So, did anybody ask any questions why?
Everyone knew that things were getting very tense because there was a major buildup of forces on the other side of the border. But nobody necessarily knew when war would start or if it would start. Okay, so it was assumed in the early 1970s that if war were to happen on the initiative of the Arabs, Israel would probably have 5 or 6 days advance warning, and at the very, very minimum, they would have 48 hours of advanced warning. Why was that the thinking? Because of special means of collection. What were the special means of collection? So there were bugs, listening devices, placed in sensitive locations in the Egyptian high command, Israel was listening, except Israel wasn't listening. The bugs were there, and the machinery could be turned on, but it wasn't typically turned on, because the battery could run out, or if it was beeping, it might be noticed. So the Amman intelligence service, led by General Eli Zeira, he, who's by the way still alive, 90 years old, and is the main person to be blamed for the debacle that was the war, he was of the opinion not to turn on these special devices except in extraordinary circumstances. Yet he didn't think that the events of October 1st through 5th, 1973, warranted being called special circumstances. And so it wasn't until the morning of the war that he turned on the boxes, and the chatter was obvious that war was imminent. Okay. And worse yet, he misled the political establishment into having them think that he turned on the devices and that he still thought nothing was going to happen, when in fact he knew nothing because he hadn't turned on the devices.
Robert Kamen, this guy. I know you told me he said to us that he's still alive.
He's still alive. And
one
problem. Yeah.
What happened to him? Was he charged with anything?
He never went to jail or anything. He was ousted from his position after the war.
Wasn't there an overall philosophy of Princeton that were superhuman, who went through the 67?
Okay, yes.
Didn't do anything?
Yes, yes. Okay, so the issue here is Israel's thinking was lulled by hubris, that it was invincible and indestructible. Whereas Arab thinking was sharpened by desperation, so that Israel became soft intellectually when it came to the concepts of warfare, and the Arabs changed the nature of their fighting force to be from cowards to something courageous. They actually did something else as well. In 1967, most of the soldiers in the Egyptian army were illiterate peasants, the fellahin. But in the late 60s, early 70s, the Egyptians drafted university graduates who now were cerebral enough to know how to fight a modern war. And so the Arab armies were less incompetent than they were before. I wouldn't say they were wise and the top-notch, but there was a marked improvement in their fighting capabilities.
They fought bravely.
Very bravely, yes, very bravely. Okay. There was another source of information that was believed to be reliable and that would indicate to Israel whether or not war was imminent. And he was known as the source. Who was this source? So for 30 years after the war, nobody knew who it was, outside of the inner circle who knew who it was. Now it is assumed that this was Nasser's son-in-law by the name of Marwan Ashraf, who died in 2007 under dubious circumstances. It's unclear whether he was assassinated or not. I think it was in London. There were those who claimed that he was a double agent working for both sides, but really working for the Egyptians. And Zaira would claim that because he wanted to cover for himself. But the evidence suggests that he was just working for financial gain on behalf of the Israelis. And he had provided tremendous information that proved to be accurate in the years leading up to the war. However, he also said there was going to be war in May of 1973, and Israel called up the reserves in what was known as the blue and white episode. It was a false alarm. So because it was a false alarm, the anti-alarmists were supposedly vindicated, namely Eli Zaira, the head of Amman. So when he could say, no, there isn't going to be war and these guys are off base, and it turns out, at least in that instance, that he was right, makes him look like a Groy Sechachem. And so the next time around, people believe him when he's in fact dead wrong. That was one of the big problems. Okay, but there was something else. The blue and white episode involved a heavy concentration of forces on the part of Egypt near the canal. But when it was over, yes, there was no fighting. But not all of that concentration of materiel actually left the canal zone. It was put under blankets, under camouflage, and remained there. And somehow Israel remained either oblivious to it or disregarded that. But it was pretty clear evidence, in hindsight, that war would happen some point in the near term. Just not in that instance, not in May. It would have to wait till the fall. Okay. What was Sadat's intention? So, Sadat believed, and in Israel they didn't understand this at the time, and Kissinger would be the first one to fully comprehend it. Sadat believed that by gaining a foothold in the Sinai, he could initiate a political dialogue that would result in not just a ceasefire and holding on to whatever limited gains he made militarily, but also further talks that would result in Israel relinquishing the entire Sinai and Egypt regaining what it had once had. So this thinking on the part of Sadat was mamash nevuah, because that's exactly how things turned out. But Israel didn't fathom that that was the intention. Okay, so Israel understood.
What we're thinking about here now,
yeah,
is that there was a road that's being built, intellectually,
yeah,
that would recognize Israel, that Israel to obliterate Israel was off the agenda.
Off the agenda completely.
That is, in and of itself, is a big revolution.
Yes, yes, of course. Of course. He was the chief architect. Now, Moshe Dayan did understand that war was an option for Egypt to break the political stalemate, and that if war went well for Egypt, and by going well, I mean some territorial gain, they would leverage that for further gain. But Dayan, ever the two-faced person he was, and speaking out of both sides or three sides of his mouth, on the other hand, said there isn't going to be war for 10 more years. Of course, 2 days later, there was a war. So Dayan did not have a clear grasp on what was likely to happen. But
you put a lot of emphasis on Egypt.
Yeah.
What about Syria? Syria lost the Golan Heights, but
okay, good, good. So now let's get to the concept. What was the concept? The concept was the doctrine that Israel operated under throughout the early 70s, up until the day of the war, when it became obsolete. The concept was that Egypt will not go to war until it has Air Force capacity to do a few things. One, bomb Israeli cities, and two, release Scud missiles. Why do they need these two things? Because absent them, they'll be dominated by the Israeli Air Force, and they won't be able to have a credible threat against the civilian population. So they're not going to go to war unless they have those things, which they need to get from the Soviet Union, which they don't yet have, although the Scuds they get on August 24th. The other thing was, Egypt must go to war for the Arabs to go to war at all. In other words, Syria can't go it alone. Syria is too weak to go it alone with war with Israel, so the whole focus must be on the canal and on the Egyptians. Yes, if we get nervous, then we'll have to focus on the Syrian front as well. But Syria will not go to war alone. All right, so...
What was the absence of Jordan in this discussion?
Ah, so Jordan, on several occasions, King Hussein made trips to Tel Aviv to discuss matters with Golda Meir. On September 25th, 1973, King Hussein flew to Tel Aviv and had a two-hour sit-down with Golda and explained to her that war was likely to happen very, very shortly. This was not ignored, but also not acted upon in any real way. Why did King Hussein do this? Well, he owed one to Israel ever since Black September of 1970. Why did he even know? Why was he kept in the loop by Sadat and Assad? The answer is that Sadat and Assad may have been hoping against hope that the Jordanians would agree to get involved, as they had agreed in 1967, but he refused. Why did he refuse? Because when he got involved in 67, he lost half his kingdom, and he doesn't want to die. And he figured if he goes to war again, it's curtains for him. It's a good thing he didn't go to war, because Israel didn't have the ability to fight on a third front. As it is, they could barely fight on two fronts. During the war, there were about a handful of soldiers guarding the Jordan River. Almost nobody. Had a front been open up there, it would have been a disaster. Israel had to put landmines on the roads leading from the Jordan River bridges just on the off chance that the Jordanians invade, that they should be stopped by some kind of explosions along the way. But really, there was no serious defense of the central sector. Okay. Well, as I mentioned, Dayan didn't think war was going to happen anytime soon, but you always have to be careful and come up with solutions just in case there is a cross-canal invasion. So Israel had an idea. How do we prevent the Egyptians from getting across the canal? Well, mamash like the 10 plagues, fire on water, you burn the canal. So tanker fluid was put in these basins at the bottom of the canal at 15 junctures all along the eastern side, and with a pull of a lever, this fluid could be flooded into the canal and set on fire. Fire on water. This was an invention of General David Laskov, who was a 66-year-old engineer, the oldest person active duty in the IDF. He also was the one who invented the roller bridge, which ultimately allowed Israel to cross to the western side of the canal during the course of the war. So this idea of putting fire in the canal, it failed because the Egyptians knew about it and they blocked the pipes shortly before the war started. So and even if they hadn't blocked the pipes, testing on the scheme turned out that it probably wasn't going to work all that well anyway. But they had to figure out ways to prevent a cross-canal raid by the Egyptians, and different ideas were put out there. Ultimately, it was going to be relying upon the 60-foot-high sand dunes, artificial sand ramparts. But there's a solution from the Egyptian point of view to cut through it. And what is that?
Water.
Water. You just spray with the hose for about 4 or 5 hours, and you'll have the sand dune collapse and a path right through it. The thinking on Israel's part was, in those 5 hours, we'll be able to mobilize sufficient forces to block the path. That didn't work out too well.
Why didn't they even have people? They had very few people on the canal. Israel.
Yes, very few. 444.
So if they knew of war coming, why didn't they at least...
Okay, because knowing about war coming in the abstract is one thing. Knowing that it's going to happen like in an hour and 45 minutes from now is quite another. And at that point, the idea was we don't withdraw, we don't lose any territory. Hold the canal. It was a silly idea, but it was one that was implemented. As we'll see next week, of the various bunkers, every last one of them except the northernmost one, Budapest, fell. Only Budapest survived, which is important because the commander of Budapest would become the leader of the protest movement after the war, Mati Ashkenazi. Yeah.
So, was there concern? Israel was obviously focusing on Sinai, but was there any serious concern that if the Egyptians went to war, the Syrians would likewise go to war, and that they needed to fortify the ground? Specifically, since the two generals, or two former generals, are saying, well, it's reasonable to have a tactical retreat 20 miles to Gideon Mittler, Why was Syria left so empty?
The answer to that is that Elazar believed the disparity in the number of forces is not necessarily a problem, that 800 tanks versus 100 tanks was enough for Israel to survive. Of course, that's only in the short term, before the major mobilization. The bulk of Israel, of the IDF, is in the reserves. And the only question is, when do you mobilize them? So let's now look at how that happened. Actually, before that, let me explain the war aims. Egypt and Syria collaborated, but not really. They only collaborated on one thing, to go to war at a certain day and a certain time, but not what would happen a minute after that. They deceived each other. Egypt deceived Syria, Syria deceived Egypt. Officially, at the formal level of communication, they agreed to go to war on Yom Kippur on Saturday, October 6, 1973, at an hour of mutual agreement, which the Egyptians wanted 10 in the morning. The Syrians wanted 6 in the evening. The Egyptians wanted 6 in the evening, the Syrians wanted 10 in the morning. Why did the Syrians want 10 in the morning? So the Israelis would be looking in the sun. Ultimately, they settled on 2 o'clock as a pshara, as a compromise. But the only agreement was about going to war. The thinking was that the war would last a long time, and that Egypt would try to conquer the entire Sinai, and that Syria would try to conquer the Golan Heights and then even press on into Israel proper. However, neither side really believed that internally. They said that to the other side, but they didn't really think so. Egypt deceived Syria in that Egypt had no intention of moving past a short distance from the canal. They wanted to get 10, 20 miles, a bridgehead, and stop, and use that territorial gain to pursue an agenda of formal negotiations with Israel to recover the rest of the Sinai by peaceful means. So, that was a deception, because the Syrians thought that if Egypt really fights all the way to the Israeli border at the Negev, then Israel is going to be tied down in the south and will not have sufficient forces to fight the Syrian army on the Golan, and Syria will be able to conquer the Golan facing almost nobody. The IDF will just not be there. That was how Egypt deceived Syria. Syria deceived Egypt in that Egypt was under the impression that Syria was going to fight for not just a few days, but a week or two, giving enough time for Egypt to make its advances, however far it was going to go. But Syria actually had no intention of doing that at all. It had the intention of conquering most of the Golan Heights in 2 days, and then begging the Soviet Union to go to the United Nations and imposing a ceasefire so that there would be no Israeli counterattack. The Syrians understood they could conquer most of the Golan at a first thrust, but an Israeli counterattack would probably defeat them, as ultimately would happen in the course of the war. But so they figured we could prevent that with an early ceasefire. An early ceasefire would mess over the Egyptians, who still had yet to do much other than cross the canal. So they're lying to each other, but such is the nature of the Arab world. Okay. The evidence was mounting that something was going to happen. There was a build-up on the Syrian front and on the Egyptian front that was visible to the naked eye for those stationed on the Golan and those stationed on the canal. Moreover, aerial reconnaissance showed that there was a very, very large build-up. So how could Israel explain this to itself in a way that would mean something other than war? In other words, if Israel was caught surprised, but the evidence would indicate that it shouldn't have been surprised, then how was it surprised? That's the psychological question here. So there are several answers. One, the most important one was the concept. They're not going to go to war until they have X, Y, or Z materiel, and the Syrians will not go to war without Egypt. Or, number two, the Arabs are afraid of us. We're strong, they're weak, they think they can't win, therefore they won't fight. But those are general issues that date back to the Six-Day War. There are also specific issues dating to October of 1973. And that is, on the Egyptian side, there was a major military exercise scheduled for October 1st through 7th, known as Tahrir 41. So whenever you see beyond the canal, in the yonder, that there are hundreds of tanks or whatever else there is, well, it's an exercise. There's no intention to actually go to war. Well, you can say that 1,000 times. It doesn't mean it's true. And on the Syrian side, Syrian nervousness over international scuttlebutt that Israel intended to go to war. In other words, just like the Six-Day War all over again, where the Soviets were feeding information that Israel intended to attack Syria, the Syrians are nervous, so they're putting forces near the front. Not that they're going to attack us, they think we're going to attack them. So they're making defensive maneuvers as a precaution. Well, is that true? No, it isn't true, but if you say it 1,000 times, you'll think it's true. So these are the various ways that, in the head games, Israel convinced itself nothing was to alarm them. Okay. So there were those in the general staff who were more than just suspicious, who thought that something really could go wrong. And that General Tal, especially, believed that war was about to happen. And so they pressured Zaira in the intelligence service, are you collecting the data? Did you turn on the boxes? Are we getting information? And he says, no, we're getting no information. No information. Golda Meir admitted that she doesn't know anything about military affairs. And she didn't. She relied upon her advisors. Her advisors being Dayan, the defense minister, Galili, the minister without portfolio, Alon, the education minister and deputy prime minister, and David Elazar, the chief of staff, with whom she had a very good relationship. And if they were calming her nerves, that don't worry, Grandma Golda, everything is going to be okay, well, so she was calm. She went to Austria in late September. But I think on Tzom Gedalia, the day after Rosh Hashanah. Why did she go to Austria? What happened in Austria in 1973?
Austrian Prime Minister was
Bruno Kreisky.
Good. So the Austrian Prime Minister was a Jew, but he was a Gino, a Jew in name only. He was a socialist. That was his religion. And Austria was the transit point for Jews coming from Soviet bloc to get to the Western world, including to go to Israel. And there was a Palestinian terror attack in September of 1973 in one of the transit camps. And Kreisky's response was to close down the camp, to which Golda then went there and said, Bruno, how could you do this? You know, don't you have a Jewish heart? And Bruno's response was, no, I don't. Afterwards, she said, he didn't so much as offer me a cup of water. That it was a very adversarial relationship between the two of them. Despite both being Jews and socialists, one was an anti-Jew. So Kreisky had been warned by the Egyptian foreign minister about a week earlier that war was about to happen. And he didn't tell Golda. Why not? The Egyptian foreign minister warned the Austrian prime minister, chancellor, that war was on the verge of happening. Why did he say nothing? So, number one, he might not want to get involved. Number two, he might not care. He doesn't care to defend Israel in the least, even by just the word of mouth. But the other was, he didn't believe it was true. Arabs like to say hot air, bluff. And he thought it was just another bluff on the part of the Egyptians. So it wasn't only the Israelis who could stare the evidence in the face and say, well, we'll have to ignore it because it's not really evidence. Okay. So
did the Arabs go around telling everybody that they're going to be having war?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know.
If they want a secret.
Okay.
Did
so,
Kresge ever explain himself?
No, never.
Did anybody ever ask him in public?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't think he was ever confronted.
I think Kresge's brother lived in Jerusalem.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
Oh. Kresge's older brother
lived in Jerusalem? Yeah.
As a Jew?
Right, yeah, he's a Jew, yeah.
I don't know if a religious Jew.
But as a Jew? So, the Soviets were not happy with being told that war was imminent. They were also told. Why don't the Soviets want war?
They can't control it.
Well, they could try once war begins by sending in troops or sending in the so-called advisors and operating the equipment, which they would do to a limited extent. So they came back. In 1973, the Soviet advisors were invited back. And it was only a week before the war began, when they were warned that war is imminent, that the women and children, the family members of the non-essential personnel, were evacuated in large planes back to Moscow. So Israel saw this as a very ominous sign. This is not good. I mean, the advisors themselves remained, only the family members left. That means that war seems pretty likely. But again, it was dismissed as, well, like all the other evidence we're going to ignore. But why did the Soviet Union oppose this war so vehemently before it started? Well, the answer is that if the Arabs lose, which was expected, it means that a Soviet client loses to an American client. And Soviet weaponry loses to American weaponry. But, on the other hand, what if the Arabs win? Then they no longer need to be Soviet clients. So it's a lose-lose proposition for the Soviets. Either they lose, or the winner doesn't need them anymore. And then goes into the camp of the Americans pursuing, you know, a further Middle East agenda. So from the Russian perspective, this war was a bad idea. But once the war starts, the Soviets have no choice but to hope that their side wins, and wins big. That doesn't happen, but they tried, with airlifts and having people on the ground. Okay. What about the changing warfare made things so dangerous for Israel that they didn't necessarily foresee? So the SAMs and the SAGRs. The SAMs, surface-to-air missiles, were going to knock out the ability of the Israel Air Force to inflict an early blow against the Egyptians, or for that matter, to provide air cover in tank battles. And the SAGRs meant that in conflict in the open field, or with a little bit of not-so-open field with some brush, you could have a guy with a suitcase with a wire and a joystick knocking out tanks. This had not existed in the previous war, and Israel was not really prepared for this kind of fighting. They would have to change their style in the midst of the battle. But that said, Israel was preparing to deal with the SAMs, it's just that they were unsuccessful. Next week we'll talk about how this played itself out, but there were two operations that had been devised, never fully practiced because you can't practice it, known as Tagger and Dugman, or Tagar and Dugman. Tagger was against the Egyptian Air Force, against the Egyptian SAM batteries, and Dugman against the Syrians, in which basically the whole Israeli Air Force would be sent at one time against these missile batteries to wipe them out in a manner of flying that would go up and down and up and down so as to avoid being locked on by the missile. It could have worked, they say, but during the course of the war, it was aborted against Egypt, and it failed against Syria. So Israel understood the nature of this war is going to be different if it happens, and they came up with some ideas, but these ideas were not foolproof, and sometimes they didn't work. Okay, so on Friday, October 5th, there was a partial cabinet meeting in Tel Aviv. Why in Tel Aviv? Because that's where Golda was, at her office. Not everyone was there. Who wasn't there? Those ministers who lived in Jerusalem and were there for Yom Kippur and were not interested in being in Tel Aviv at 11:30 on Erev Yom Kippur. So, at this point, war is looking very likely, but there are still the naysayers who claim it's not going to happen. Tzvi Zamir, the head of the Mossad, went to London on Friday morning to meet with the source, the so-called source, to find out what's really happening. And the source said, yes, war is going to be tomorrow. What time, he didn't say, but war is going to start tomorrow. This message was passed along to Eli Zaira back at the Kiryat in Tel Aviv, but he did not pass along this information at 5 o'clock p.m. when he got it. He waited until 9 o'clock to release it to David Elazar and the rest of the general staff. Those 4 hours were a very critical 4 hours that could have made a difference in hastening the mobilization. So at the cabinet meeting in the middle of the day, Dayan refused the general mobilization unless the Arabs made the first move. Why? It's one thing to reject a preemptive strike, a la June 5th, 1967, but why reject a full mobilization? Because in Dayan's view, the Egyptians would regard that as casus belli, as act of war. An act of war. So therefore, you don't do it. If we're not going to do preemptive, we're also not going to do full mobilization. But the cabinet did do one important thing. It authorized Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan to do a general mobilization at the time of their choosing without further reconvening the cabinet, which might prove difficult on a holy day, on Yom Kippur. Okay.
I think they did authorize mobilizing the Air Force.
Yes, okay. So Elazar, without permission from the cabinet, told Benny Peled, the head of the Air Force, get everybody, call them all up. So this was not even a political decision so much as it was like an emergency personal decision made by the chief of staff. Okay. The cabinet secretary collected telephone numbers of all the ministers. This is in the age before cell phones and Yom Kippur, so people are either going to be home or in shul. And how can we reach you if we need you? Because we may need to reconvene the cabinet on Yom Kippur. So give us your phone number. And the Air Force was called up at the authorization of Elazar. On Friday, there were some other unfriendly signs that war was about to happen. There were footprints all over the eastern bank of the canal, near the various fortresses on the Barlev line, including around Budapest. Who were these people? Whose footprints were they? So these were Egyptian commandos that had crossed the day before, either by swimming in the canal or possibly even by parachute drop or helicopter that went unnoticed and were snooping around to try to get a lay of the land of the Barlev line. They didn't shoot anyone. They weren't even seen, but they were there. And the fellows in the fortresses were getting nervous. What's happening here? Why do we not know what's going on? Then the question was, well, if you're not going to have a general mobilization, are you going to have any mobilization? You got to have something. We can't be totally caught off guard. So Elazar wanted 200,000 men, which is basically the whole thing. He wasn't going to get that. Dayan wanted 20,000 to 30,000 men. But they decided that Golda Meir would make the final decision on this thing. It was not going to be decided by Dayan or Elazar. Golda would make the decision. And ultimately it would be for a limited call-up, to be then rescinded in favor of a general call-up the next morning. Overnight, it was discovered that the war was going to start at 6 p.m. It turned out that was wrong. That was an idea that the Egyptians had in mind to start at 6 p.m. Ultimately, it would start at 2 or 1:59. So Israel thought, well, we have at least some wiggle room here to do a mobilization on Saturday. Little did they know, much less time than they thought. So only on Saturday morning were the special means of collection finally turned on, and Israel discovered that the war is going to happen very, very shortly, and they found out 2 o'clock, not 6 o'clock. The cabinet met at noon in Tel Aviv. The full mobilization started at 9:25 in the morning. So that means about 5 hours before the war. The cabinet decided the following. There is no territorial ambition in this war. The goal is to destroy enemy forces. So this differs from the Six-Day War, where there was major territorial ambition. Now, it was not said explicitly before the Six-Day War, but it was pretty obvious that Israel would like to expand its borders. The old so-called Auschwitz borders were not good. But the borders of June 11, 1967 were very, very good borders. And there's really no desire to go beyond that. So the issue is destroying the enemy. Yeah?
If they knew 3 or 4 hours before the war was supposed to start that it was happening,
yes.
Why didn't they do a preemptive airstrike?
Good, good, good. So good question. The answer to that is that Dayan and Golda Meir were both under the impression if they did this, they would be condemned by everyone, including the Americans, and that the issue so much wasn't the condemnation as it was Israel is going to need American assistance at some point in the war if it's a protracted war. That Israel has limited manpower and limited materiel. You're going to need an American airlift. So if there's an Israeli preemptive strike, the likelihood is the Americans will not be so forthcoming with weapons. It turned out that Henry Kissinger and James Schlesinger and a few of the others in the Nixon administration admitted openly, had you guys fired the first shot, you wouldn't have gotten anything, so much as a tank, let alone hundreds of them. So, yeah.
Did Israel communicate their knowledge that it was going to start to the U.S.?
Yes, yes. This was communicated to the Americans and to the Egyptians and to the Syrians, requesting that it not happen, and to the Jordanians requesting that they not get involved in the war. So it was known to everyone shortly before the firing started. Okay, well,
I recall something at that time, as you know, that it was Kissinger that was opposed to any assistance as far as Israel is concerned, and it was Nixon who just told him straight out to just take his business. He'll take the responsibility. He was the one that ordered unlimited.
Okay, so it is true that there were those in the administration who believed in a limited airlift to Israel for reasons of political constraint. The idea being, if you give too much, you'll get too much flack for it. And Nixon's response was, we'll get blamed if you give them one tank, if you give them 1,000 tanks. So give them everything we got. So cleaned out the arsenal. All 25 C-5As at the American arsenal were sent loaded with stuff to go to Israel on October 13th and 14th. So Nixon was very much in favor of a robust American assistance to Israel in the course of the war. There were those who opposed it altogether. And there was Kissinger who was playing a sort of a two-sided game, which... Well, next week we'll discuss why he was playing a two-sided game. Okay. Dayan's voice...
Did Russia supply subsequent arms?
Yes, in a big way. More than what was lost in the battlefield, the Soviets resupplied the Egyptians and the Syrians.
So it was a real chess match between Washington...
Absolutely, absolutely. So
much of that landed up in the Israeli army.
Yes, Israel captured intact a significant amount of that war booty. Okay, so there was a tremor in Dayan's voice at the cabinet meeting on Yom Kippur afternoon, at the noontime meeting. He was nervous. Remember, he had been poo-pooing the possibility of war all throughout the summer and fall of 1973, and now it turns out that he's dead wrong. So he is nervous about what will happen to the country and his role in whatever disaster may unfold. Then the time comes to go to war. Well, it's a fast day. It's Yom Kippur. Who's fasting?
Most of the people in Israel.
On which side of the canal are people fasting?
Jews. Ramadan, both.
Both sides, bingo. It was Ramadan, and it was Yom Kippur. So everybody's fasting. Nobody had breakfast.
Oh, wow.
All right, so in the morning of October 6th, both sides encourage their fighters to break the fast. The IDF chaplains are telling boys, you have to eat something to get your strength. And on the other side of the canal, it's Ramadan, and the Frumma Egyptians don't want to eat. So Anwar Sadat does what Rabbi Yisrael Salanter did, Lahavdil Elef Havdalos, in 1848 during a typhus outbreak, What did Rabbi Sura Salanter do? He got up in front of the pulpit on Yom Kippur, said, Shakol Niyeh, but Varon had a cup of water to show you, you can't fast this year. Everybody's, you know, sick and dying. We have to have our strength. So what did Sadat do in the general staff at Center 10, which was where the Egyptian general staff was gathered? He ordered from the butler, get me a cup of tea and a cigar. And he drank the tea and he smoked the cigar. Because the halachic ruling for the Muslims was not only could you eat and drink, you could even smoke. Because this was the 70s, remember, and smoking was like a necessity, like eating and drinking. All right, so that was the breaking of the fast, which means for sure we're going to war here. Okay. In the few minutes we have left, just to discuss the beginnings of the fighting.
Why did he pick that day if he knew it was Ramadan, just because it was Yom Kippur?
Okay, so why pick Yom Kippur? The answer is that it had something to do with the tide and the moon and visibility at night played a role, because the canal crossing was going to happen basically at night. It began with guys in the dinghies and the rubber boats going across and shooting water cannons at the sand, but the bulk of the forces would come across while it was dark out. So there was an element of that. Also, the thinking was, we'll catch the Jews off guard on their holiest day of the year. It turned out that was actually a mistake, because of all the days of the year, when from an Israeli point of view, people are wandering around, you don't know where they are for mobilization purposes. On Yom Kippur, everybody's either home or in the synagogue. And so mobilization was a lot easier on Yom Kippur than it would have been on another day of the year. But the religious angle was not lost on the Egyptians. They wanted to stick it to the Jews, and this was a way of doing it. Also, the exercise in the Sinai was a convenient cover for the massive mobilization of forces and material. So, therefore, October 6th, being the second to last day of this supposed exercise, it was a good time to catch the Jews off guard. Okay, so the war is going to begin. The invasion begins roughly around 2 o'clock on the northern and southern frontiers. And the mobilization of forces in Israel was, of course, just beginning. And it was going to take a good 2 days for forces to reach the front, equipped, whatever it is that they need, and at the battle site. So, in the immediate term, who's holding the line? Very few people. In the Golan, very small force, 100 tanks. In Egypt, so you had the Bar-Lev line, but behind the Bar-Lev line, you had, on the artillery road, which was a few miles inland, a secondary forces, and then you had tertiary forces even further inland. But still, not that many. Maybe there were 250 tanks in the Sinai before the war started. So this is going to be a very ugly day for the IDF. And the news is going to trickle back to headquarters, but it's not going to be revealed to the general public, at least not yet. And even to Golda Meir, the news is not going to be revealed in its most manner. It's going to be sugar-coated by David Elazar, so as not to cause Golda to go into a complete panic. But there's only so long before real information gets to the highest level. And at that point, what is Golda's reaction? Oh my God. What else? She wanted to commit suicide. So she contemplated suicide briefly and was talked out of it. Not that she necessarily really had to be talked out of it, but her longtime assistant, Lou Kedar, was always with her all through the years, calmed her nerves and said, you know, the country needs you. The country needs you. Dayan offered to resign on day 2 of the war because he felt this was his major blunder. He had not foreseen what would happen, so he has to pay the political price. But Golda doesn't want that, because to have the defense minister resign in the middle of the battle, it would demoralize everyone. It would be a disaster. So therefore, she rejects that offer. She would reject it a second time later in the war. It would ultimately be accepted after the war was over in April of 1974 as part of the political aftermath of the whole conflict. But he offers to resign and it has to be rejected. So Dayan is nervous, and in his nervousness he says, the third temple is in danger. The third temple is in danger. What's the third temple? Medinat Yisrael, the state of Israel, is the third temple. You know, he's not a religious man, but he uses the nomenclature of the third temple. Who's running this war? Who's really in charge? So, it's interesting. We're going to see next week that Bar-Lev returns to the battlefield. Bar-Lev was the former chief of staff. The line was named after him because he was the chief of staff when it was constructed. But he's going to be brought back. Why? Because of the incompetence of the southern commander. But at the top, you have Golda, who knows nothing about warfare and admits it. So she's going to rely exclusively on the generals. Dayan is the minister. Is the minister in charge of conducting warfare? No. The chief of staff is. The minister can only give instructions to the chief of staff. The chief of staff gives instructions to everyone else who's in active service. But Moshe Dayan, being a former chief of staff himself and a war hero and considered, you know, the greatest Leilo Leilam in Kol Brachas V'Shirasa, so he will offer ministerial advice. Whenever he tells a commander who's lower than David Elazar to do this, why, that, or the other thing, he has to put a caveat of, I can't really tell you to do this, it's just ministerial advice. But that meant, you better do it. So he's bossing people around, despite it not being formally his job to do so. But Golda, as the war will progress, will come to realize that Dayan doesn't have all the answers, and Elazar is better equipped to give her the good solutions to the problems of war. As I mentioned, Peled was the head of the Air Force, and then General Chofi was the head of the Northern Command. The head of the Southern Command was a man by the name of Shmuel Gonen. Now, Shmuel Gonen was an odd character, and he was not well-liked. Why was he the Southern Commander? Because Ariel Sharon, who had been the Southern Commander for 3 years, from 1970 to 73, was fired. Well, not so much fired as after 3 years as a front commander, they cycle you out unless they give you an extension. Sharon asked Moshe Dayan for an extension of one more year because he believed there's going to be a war this year and you guys need me at the Southern Front. Dayan's response in the summer of or in the spring of 73 was, "No, there won't be a war this year. It's okay. You can take leave of the army." So he did. What did he do? Went into politics. He founded the Likud. He founded the Likud, a merger of the Gachal, of the Land of Israel movement, of the Free Center, and of the State List. And he's the power broker behind all this. Menachem Begin is, of course, the head honcho, but Sharon is the behind-the-scenes power broker. And he is given a reserve commission in the army, which means that when war breaks out, he's going to become a division commander, and he's going to be underneath the chain of command, his successor. So in this Yom Kippur War, you have an odd situation where people are working as a deputy or an underling to someone who used to be their own underling. But Gonen was a wacky guy, and he was way overconfident. Him and Zaira are the two ones who basically messed up, and Gonen had to be replaced. He would be replaced by Bar-Lev. Bar-Lev agreed to resign from the government. He was Minister of Commerce. He was already a politician. Left the cabinet to rejoin the army and oust, you know, shove Gonen aside. Just to give you an example of what Gonen did.
General.
Huh?
As a lieutenant general,
yeah. So, and what Gonen did, for example, he would get violent. If someone said something that he didn't like, he would throw something at you. So there was an underling who was a fairly significant reserve officer, who in civilian life was a major professor of economics at Hebrew University, and he said one thing that Gonen didn't like, that Gonen threw a phone at him and hit him in the head. This is a Meshuggah. So it became clear to Dayan and to Golda and to Elazar that Gonen had to go, and Barlev was the solution. And so Barlev played an important role in helping win the war. Okay, so we'll stop here. And next time...